this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 27th, 2011, and this is show number 341. Well, the excitement's starting to heat up for Macworld in January. I know this has got to be a torturous time for those of you too far away to attend. I'm getting emails about people crawling into closets with bottles of wine until the end of January so they don't have to hear about it anymore. But for those of you who will be making the trek in 2012, I hope you'll come to the third annual NoSilla Castaways Party. It'll be on Friday night from 6 to 8 p.m. at Jillian's, which is right around the corner from Moscone Center in a place they call the Metreon. If you can come, here's how to register. Click on the link in the menu bar that says NoSilla Castaways Party 2012 over on podfeet.com, or if you're actually reading those show notes along with our home game, you can follow the link that I did put in the show notes right here. You'll find that it's password protected. Enter the word screen steps, all lowercase, all one word. From there, you simply enter your name, email address, and Twitter handle if you have it, and then click submit. On that same page, there's a PayPal button just in case you want to donate to the party fund. It is definitely not required, but some people seem to like to help out, and they've asked me to do that, so this is the easiest way to let people know how they can contribute. You'll also get a confirmation page once you register. Now, I have to thank Connor for helping me set this up this year. He taught me how to use Google Docs Forms. Last year, it was a nightmare doing it with a plugin from WordPress, and I tried like 30 of them. The one I ended up with did work, but I spent hours and hours cleaning out spam from it. It's amazing how many people from Russia said they were coming to the party. With this password-protected page, it seems that it's going to work a lot better. So I really enjoyed learning about how Google Forms work. Turns out they're really easy to create. Basically, you set up a list of questions with answer options like radio buttons and checkboxes and free text entry fields. You can even have an action caused by the choice of a radio button. Think, will you be bringing a guest? Followed by yes-no buttons that trigger a new field for guest name if you say yes. But then it jumps to the next question, if you said no. I had some trouble working the logic, like I wanted to have an option where if you said you wanted to donate, it would take you to the donation page, but if not, it would skip you past that. But it turns out you can't really enter any HTML or anything like that, so I wasn't able to put the donate button in there, so I just gave up on that whole track. They do have a whole pile of themes to choose from, but even there I wanted to center some text, and I couldn't do that in HTML. Kind of would have liked to have been able to do it. Anyway, the great news is that the invite page creates a Google spreadsheet showing the time someone registered, their name, email address, and Twitter name. Much easier than the lame plugin I used last year, that's for sure. Anywho, I hope if you're coming to Macworld, you come to the party to say hello. Heck, if you're in the area not coming to Macworld, still come over and say hi. Speaking of Macworld iWorld, how annoying is that new name? I understand why they changed it, because it's not all about the Mac anymore, since covering Apple is so much more these days. But still, Macworld iWorld? It's not that hard to say, but typing it is a real pain. First of all, if you don't want the purists like Dave Hamilton hollering at you, you have to remember that the W in Macworld is not capitalized. But remember also that the W in iWorld is capitalized, but the I in front of it is not capitalized. Oh, man. As if all that wasn't enough, there's a pipe between the two words. If you're a programming type, or, say, a sysadmin, you know what a pipe is. But for normal people, they aren't going to know what it is in the first place. It turns out it's that little vertical bar on the key with what I think is the backslash. I always get confused which one's back and which one's forward. But anyway, the key right above the Enter key. All right, so we've got Macworld with a lowercase w, then space, pipe, space, then iWorld with a lowercase I and an uppercase w. Well, I got to tell you, the very first time I saw this new name, I popped open Text Expander and pasted it in as a new snippet, and I abbreviated it with MWIW. So with four keystrokes, I can easily type Macworld Pipe iWorld with all the capitalization done for me. Now think how many characters that's already saved me just while writing up the show notes for this episode. If you don't already have Text Expander, and who wouldn't, but there appear to be three of you left, head on over to smilesoftware.com and download the free trial. You'll be hooked really quickly. Then, I want you to use the link in the show notes to Text Expander for Mac in the Mac App Store so you can get it for all of your Macs. Go forth and type Macworld Pipe iWorld to your heart's content. Well, let's keep going with a little more plugging away here. The holiday season is upon us, but these days it's a lot easier than it used to be. I used to go to the malls, fight the traffic, fight for a parking place, dig through piles of junk, searching for the perfect present. I am so much happier now buying most of the presents I buy online. My stress levels about the holidays, it's dropped like 90%. I think having Amazon there for the most centralized place to buy things make things even easier for me. If you're going to be shopping through Amazon this holiday season, I was wondering if maybe you'd think about using the Amazon affiliate link in the sidebar over at podfeet.com. All you got to do is, instead of going to amazon.com, click on the link, click on the Amazon picture that I have in the upper left sidebar, and when it takes you to Amazon, anything you buy there will send around 3% of the purchase price back to support the show. You pay the same price as if you'd bought it normally, but the show gets a little coin back in the coffers. I'd sure appreciate it if you would try this out. Oh, and if you're buying through the Mac App Store, if you're buying anything there, click on the lion in the right-hand sidebar and a small bit of change goes to the show there too. Thanks, I appreciate it. Well, we were all excited when we got our first iPads with no clue to what part they would play in our lives. We quickly figured out that this little device could do amazing things we'd never dreamed we'd need to do. But I bet that about 80% of the people who've used an iPad thought, you know, it'd be really cool if I could take notes by hand with this. Now, typing is cool, but sometimes it just feels easier to grab a pen and scratch paper and scribble out notes or draw a stupid little diagram to try to explain what you're trying to do. I dumpster dive pretty much weekly to the printer recycling bin at work to get paper for just this purpose. See, I don't actually print hardly anything, but I know these people who print crazy amounts. In fact, I go to my friend Linda's office and I just dumpster dive at her office because there's a lot of good stuff in there. So, when we first got our iPads, we tried to use our fingers to write and draw. Talk about epic fail. Everything we did looked like we were finger painting or maybe 2 years old. So then we went on a search for a stylus. Unfortunately, capacitive screens don't work with nicely pointed styli. I think that's the plural of stylus, isn't it? Anyway, they only work with big fat tips. Some of these came with sponges, some came with brushes, and I even heard you could use a frozen sausage as a stylus, but I never had the nerve to try that. And guess what? They all made us look like we were still finger painting. It's been so sad. All these really cool note-taking applications have sprung up, allowing us to draw and type and even record the audio from a meeting or class, but they could never really take off because there we were drawing with a sausage. All that has finally changed, though. There's a new kid in town. It's called the Jot from Adonit at adonit.net. Picture a cylindrical pen, and at the end it comes to a very fine-tipped ball point. But instead of ink or a sausage, there's a flat, clear plastic disc attached to that ball. So when you place your Jot stylus on the surface of a tablet, the plastic disc rotates on the ball until it's flat on the surface of the tablet. All right, this is a lot of words, but it really makes the use of the Jot very natural. You can place the Jot pen in a very natural writing or drawing position, and the disc does the job of being the fat sausage for the capacitive touch that you need, while what you feel is like you're doing it actually with the tip of a pen. This was actually a Kickstarter project, and my buddy Niraj showed it to me first, but then Pat Dengler actually bought me one for my very own. The regular Jot will run you $20, but for $30, you get the Jot Pro. That has a really nice little rubberized area for a nice grip, and it's also magnetized. Now, in theory, if you have an iPad 2, it'll actually stick to it with that magnet. Now, my experience playing with Niraj's, it wasn't that strong, though, so I'm not sure the magnet is all that useful. I guess it would sort of keep it near your iPad most of the time. I do like the rubberized grip, though. It feels really nice in the hand, and I'm thinking maybe that's why they make the two models, because people really like that rubber. I'm not sure. If you're interested in buying the Jot or the Jot Pro, I put a link in the show notes to it via my Amazon affiliate link. Remember that? Am I plugging that too much? Well, just for fun over Thanksgiving, I decided to add memory for two of the family's laptops, Lindsay's boyfriend Nolan's MacBook and Steve's mom Merle's MacBook. They're both the 2008 white MacBooks, and Nolan had 2 gigabytes of RAM before I started, but Merle only had one, so they really needed some help. A quick trip over to Otherworld Computing the website is actually maxsales.com, and for about $55 a piece, I was able to get them each 4 gigs of RAM. When Nolan and Lindsay came over, I decided to let Lindsay have all the fun, and in just a few minutes, she had the new RAM installed, and Nolan was delighted. Later that day, Ken and Merle, Steve's parents, made their way to our house for Thanksgiving. A Even though we were in the midst of dinner preparations, I knew this would be quick work, so I flipped over Merlee's MacBook and pulled out the battery. Then I removed the three captive screws that hold that little angle bracket that covers up the RAM slots. I flipped out the two levers, and out popped the old memory. I put in the new sticks, closed the levers, and put the angle bracket back in place. I tightened down the screws, and then I put the battery back in place. But it didn't quite sit right, so I pulled it out and I angled it in slightly differently, but it still wouldn't sit flat. Then I tried to slide it in from the other end, but it still wouldn't go in. Now, for some reason, I have always been a spaz about replacing batteries. I remember in my 2008 MacBook Pro, I could never get the battery back in on my own. I've jammed it in there sometimes where I have somebody else fix it for me. So I wasn't quite sure what was wrong with it, but I tried to hold it down with one hand and use the nickel to turn the lock, but it still wouldn't go in. So I hollered to Lindsay to stop making bruschetta for us and come help me. I asked her if she'd had any trouble getting Nolan's battery pack back in place because I just couldn't seem to get Merlee's to seat properly. Lindsay, being far more observant than me, took one look at the battery and said, "Well, that one doesn't look right. It's all bowed." I can't believe I hadn't even noticed this, but the battery had swollen up so it was completely misshapen. Now, I'd heard about batteries swelling before, but I'd never seen it in real life, and this was actually kind of frightening. Now, Ken sometimes worries unnecessarily, but this time I told him, "You really want to be alarmed about this." I suggested he make haste and get himself to an Apple store as soon as possible, so Kyle helped him make an appointment at the Genius Bar. I thought his experiences there might be of interest to you. So he met up with his little friend Jason, the genius, at the Apple store. Jason ran some tests on the battery and found that in the 4.5 years they'd used this laptop, they'd only fully discharged the battery a total of 12 times. I'm not shocked to hear this. They keep the MacBook plugged into power on a desk at all times, only carrying it away when they're on vacation. Jason suggested that this was the root cause of the battery warping. He said it's like a car battery, that it has to be exercised to stay healthy. Jason said most MacBook batteries last only 1.5 to 2 years anyway, even if they're discharged regularly. At this point, Ken made the best remark to him. He said, "So if I treated it as you suggested it, discharging it once a month, it would have lasted 1.5 to 2 years, but since I kept it plugged in all the time for 4.5 years, it lasted a lot longer?" Jason didn't have much of an answer to that. Now, I thought that was a pretty clever answer on Ken's part, but the more I thought about it, the more I wondered, how long ago would this battery have actually failed? You know, it swelled when I pulled it out. It wasn't swollen when I started, so maybe it's just been under compression and it's been waiting to swell for years. Who knows? Ken told Jason at this point that he also had an iMac desktop and he was considering buying other Apple products, and that several relatives and friends who were Apple experts told him the battery was defective and that Apple should replace it at no charge. I think Ken warmed down because after 10 or 15 minutes of discussion at 7 p.m. on Black Friday evening, Jason finally said he would make an exception for him and replace it at no charge. But this was a one-time exception. I love it when they say that because they say it a lot. On the one hand, Jason did seem to know what he was talking about. I found an article in the Made by Monkeys blog over at electronicsweekly.com where they explain how overcharging can cause a battery to swell, and they explain exactly how it happens. I mean, if you can't believe a blog called Made by Monkeys, who can you trust? On the other hand, I do think Jason made the correct decision replacing Ken's battery for several reasons, one of which is that letting him leave with that battery would have been pretty dangerous, I think. The other side effect is that Ken is very likely to buy more Apple products in the future, and this good treatment certainly helped cement his view. So, for the price of a $100 battery, it will pay off handsomely for Apple in the long run, I can assure you. I can even prove it. Ken left with a new iPad.
Hi, Allison, and fellow Nacilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from Simple Mobile Review. This week, rather than doing a pick like I traditionally do, I figured I'd tell you about a lot of the different tips and tricks that I was giving friends and family over the Thanksgiving holiday. More importantly, I felt that after Black Friday sales and spending getting ready for Christmas, most people didn't want to hear about other ways to spend money. So here we go. The first area that I was really helping people out with was around iMessage, and probably one of the most important settings that I had to do with iMessage was how to turn on read receipts. So if you're on the other end, there's nothing more valuable than someone who's courteous enough to say, send a read receipt so that people know that I've received and read their message. That for me, that's tremendously useful. It's one of the most valuable elements of BlackBerry Messenger if you're a hardcore BlackBerry user, and I think it should be an accustomed part of iMessage. To get to that, all you have to do is go to Settings, Messages, and then swap on Read Receipts. The other thing that I turn on in here are two quick changes. One is the Receive at Address. By default, your phone number is configured in here, and you can also use your iTunes or your Apple ID account. Unfortunately for many people, they created their iTunes account back in, 2002, 2003, and probably today they're using a different email address. So here's where you get to add in, let's say, your new Gmail address or Live address or Me address, whatever address it is that you're using, that people commonly email you at. You can add those in here by just going to Receive At and clicking Add an Email. Provided this email address isn't associated with like an iTunes account or something else, you'll be able to easily add it into your phone. Highly, highly recommend that configuration change. Now, as for my other suggestions on this, the other thing that I went to was how to turn off the Ask to Join Networks. So one of the most frequent annoyances and the things that I always change on the iPhone right away was go from Settings to Wi-Fi and then turn off Ask to Join Network. Nothing drives me batty on an iPhone more than sitting, you know, in the passenger seat, and as you're going through a neighborhood trying to bang out a text message or an email, you're promptly get this pop-up dialogue that's saying, do you want to join this network? Well, how about this one? You want to try this one? If you're going through a neighborhood or driving through any area where, like, you're on a highway, you constantly keep passing by, like, all these open coffee shops and Wi-Fi networks, you can understand why this is quickly one you turn off. On an iPad, it might not be so important to turn this off, but on an iPhone where you might frequently be interacting with the phone while a car is in motion, but, of course, you're safely in the passenger seat, this is one of those that I actually really turn off. The next thing that I turn off is photo streams. Honestly, it's crap right now. I hate to say it. It's just so horrible implementation. This was the most common question that I got about photo streams. Hey, I took a photo of, you know, me and my friends acting really silly. I deleted it off my camera, but how do I get it out of the photo stream? To which I can only answer, take a lot more pictures and eventually it'll fall out, because there's no way right now in photo streams to individually move a picture. Of course, we all know you can reset the photo stream, but that deletes everything out. And there's value in the fact that your photos are getting backed up. But for people who like to take those silly photos and then they get pushed into the photo stream, this isn't really useful. For me, I look at the photo stream as something as I'm going on vacation, and I want to make sure that every picture I take is fully backed up. Turn photo streams on. When you get back from vacation and you're probably going to be back with your friends taking silly bar shots, turn photo stream back off. So to turn off photo stream, all you have to do is from Settings, go to iCloud, and then swap photo stream off. Pretty much everything else for me, I have turned on in photo stream, specifically reminders, which is my next tip. Learn how to effectively use reminders. They are so, so valuable. So for me, there's two effective ways I use reminders. Someone says, could you remind me too? My wife frequently says that, like, hey, just remind me later on to do this. And I'm thinking to myself, you have an iPhone 4S just like I do. Although she still doesn't know she has an iPhone 4S, and it's been like a month. Anyway, sorry. But you can just talk to your phone and say, you know, remind me too, whatever it is, at 3 o'clock today, or in 1 hour, or in 15 minutes, and Siri will remind you. Funny enough, I use this like when I'm baking cookies. Like if I'm baking cookies and I need to run outside and check on the kids, I'll tell Siri to remind me. I also use the built-in clock app to use the countdown timer, so I get that alert, but that's beside the point. You can use Siri to remind you to remind people to do things, which is really cool. And if you tell it to remind you to call somebody, like remind me to call Chris Ashley at 4 o'clock on his mobile, when the reminder pops up, you'll be prompted to call them. Really effective way. The other way everyone's using is lists. So a quick way to create a list and be able to add to it, assuming that you have Siri, is to click on the Reminders app. From within inside of there, click on the little funny grid in the upper left-hand corner, and then click Edit. This is where you can tap Create New List. Once you create a new list, call it Grocery or Home Improvement Shopping. Then you can say to Siri, please add nails to my home improvement list. And Siri will repeat back and add the individual item. The most valuable part of having these lists is that when you're at the store, you can check each thing off the list as you go through. I am notorious for going to stores and getting yelled at by my wife when I get home, or looking at me like, this is why I don't send you to the stores, because I effectively always forget to get things. with Siri tracking all my lists, I no longer forget to bring things. So when she's looking through the bag, like, where are the eggs? It's in the other bag. I always, since I started using lists, I never forget anything at the store because everything gets checked off. I never remember to bring a pencil. I know many people think, why don't you just use pencil and paper? Because I never have a pen or pencil in my car. So I usually have a list that I'm trying to make sure that I cross things off. And because it's not in a specific order, I'm always trying to reread the list hundreds of times while I'm in the store. And it's just easier to have it on my phone. The next tip, and this will be the final one, even though I have a ton of others that I've done, is remembering that there's a private browsing option on your phone. A lot of people call it porn mode, and I think that's kind of silly. Think about this time of the year where you actually want to do holiday shopping for someone who might frequently look at your phone. Let's say your kids. With private browsing, what you can do is turn on private browsing, and when you do, from going to settings, Safari, when you slide private browsing on, it'll prompt you, do you want to close all the currently open tabs? In my case, I would close those, and then I would go do the shopping that I want to do potentially for my phone or looking up of things I want to do, and then once you're done, you can pop back over to settings, slide it off, and it'll prompt you again, would you like to close all open tabs? This ensures that you can do things, not have anything tracked in the history on the phone, and do that effective shopping that you want to do for somebody without worrying that they can sort through your iPhone history or they'll pick up your iPhone and see on the front screen something that you're picking up for them for the holidays. So those are the quick tips and the changes that I made to a lot of iOS devices. I know this tip ran long, but these were effectively all the things that I was doing over the Thanksgiving holidays, fixing people's woes with their iOS devices. Quite fun, but nonetheless, basic tips that I think everybody should know about. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this. Hopefully you had a good Turkey Day for those in the U.S. For those in Canada, you had a Turkey Day a month ago. And for everybody else, don't worry about why we have Turkey Day. Have a great week. And guys, I'll be back next week with a financial pick that you'll pay for. But I'll promise to keep these cheap and things that you can get somebody for, like a Secret Santa gift for the holidays.
So I'm with you on most of these suggestions, Rod, but how could you dislike PhotoStream? I love PhotoStream for one specific reason. I love to take pictures with my iPhone, and then they're automatically in my Aperture library. No more import required. I absolutely love it. So like today, I wanted a picture of the Jot Pro that was taken by me. So I set up my iPhone in my little Joby tripod thingy, put it up, took the picture while sitting at my laptop, and within a few seconds, the picture was in my Aperture library. I was able to export it to the size I wanted, FTP'd up to my web server, and I was done. It was a piece of cake. No plugging in cables, no syncing, waiting for it to sync all my podcasts because all I wanted was the photos, or, you know, sometimes you don't want the photos. I just don't have to deal with it ever again. It's awesome. I absolutely love PhotoStream. I don't know what everybody's so worried about having junk in your PhotoStream. Don't you have junk in your Aperture library and junk in your iPhoto library anyway? What kind of pictures are you people taking anyway? Well, anyway, on the thing you said about turning on read receipts for text messages, I'm not sure you want to turn that on. If that actually works with regular text messages and with iMessages, I'm not sure you want to turn that on because what if people have limited text messaging plans? Couldn't that be a bad thing if they got a message every time you answered a message? I really wish they're not answered, but every time you received a message. I wish it worked the other way around, that I could choose to get read receipts. The way it sounds like it works is I choose to send them to people, and maybe people don't want them. I do like the private browsing tip, but not actually because I worry about anybody looking at what I'm browsing, because nobody else actually uses my phone, but because it's an awesome, fast way to close all my tabs. Remember Rod said that when you turn it on, it says, do you want me to close all your tabs? I just did that. I went, boom, closed all my tabs, took a couple of clicks instead of close, 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 close. So I thought that was really cool. The last one was the reminders. Now, I don't know. This is the one thing I think I'd really like Siri for. I have an iPhone 4, so I don't have Siri. But on the iPhone 4, you can still do the reminders app. And so you can say things like, tell me to take out my contact lenses when I drive into the driveway. Well, I set it up to do that actual thing once. And as the garage door went over my head, my iPhone jumped up and said, don't forget to take out your contact lenses. And it was great. The second time I tried it, the GPS had gotten confused and it still thought I was 4 blocks away. So that reminder never did send itself. I'm not exactly thrilled with a 50% sample or success rate there. I guess I should give it more chances, but The location thing, if you really, really count on that, that's a little dodgy. And it's sort of like my favorite part of the Reminders app. Because, I mean, I can set a calendar event for, you know, 5 o'clock on Tuesday if I want to try to remember when I get home or when I leave work or something like that. But anyway, Rod, thanks for all the tips. That was really cool. And looking forward to some less expensive ideas for Secret Santas. Well, I talked a long time earlier in the show about how my in-laws were up for Thanksgiving and how they brought their laptops up for the memory upgrade, but I also had another mission. I had set up Merlee ages ago with automated backups with Time Machine. I think I mentioned how, like Time Machine loves to do, it had quit running on her a while back, but I'd gotten her started running a couple of weeks ago. I realized at that point that while Ken is religious about backing up his data files, they fit on a thumb drive, so he drags the entire folder every single week or every single day over to his thumb drive. He is religious about that. He doesn't have a full system backup in case of a hard drive failure. So I explained to him that it would be nice if he had one of those. If something catastrophic happened, he would be back up a lot faster. So I brought a hard drive home that I had for him to use when he was up for Thanksgiving, but I couldn't set it up for him because he's the one with the iMac at home in San Diego. So let's take a wild guess at what I did next. All right, everybody say it with me. I made him a Screen Steps tutorial, of course. I know, it's only like 3 steps to set up Time Machine, but I knew that if I handed him a lovely 3-page document with beautiful screenshots, annotated with numbered steps, big red arrows, and boxes around the important bits, the chances of a support call later would be drastically diminished. So, even if you're not an Uber geek, I am sure you help other people with their computing needs, so do yourself a favor and put Screen Steps, or Clarify, on your gift wish list for this year, and make yourself and your friends and relatives happy. I put a link to Clarify in the Mac App Store in the show notes, or you can check out Screen Steps over at screensteps.com. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you this lovely November evening?
I am fine, but I'm seeing very little lovely about this November evening. There is a storm going through here, literally.
Aw, so I shouldn't complain about it being about 60 degrees on the beach for my run this morning, then?
The fact that you are able onto the beach and to run.
Two defining factors right there.
Yeah, pretty much. There's wind and rain here.
Oh, dear. Well, every time it rains here, I think of you. I think, wow, could I do this every day? Be tough.
I have a feeling when you guys get rain, it's a bit more heavy than what we get, though.
Oh, no, Bart. We get the stupidest rain. We'll get, like, where it just spits, you know, and everybody leaves work early.
Oh, no. Panic. There's this stuff falling from the sky.
Exactly.
It's hilarious. Can't imagine what snow does to you guys.
Oh, luckily it doesn't happen, so we don't even know.
Sometime, once a century, it's bound to happen as a freak event, and then that'll be real fun.
It did snow at Disneyland once in my lifetime since I've been out here, so I guess it has happened. Well, let's go ahead and get started with Security Light, shall we?
Okie dokie, very light this week. One update which came out between the fortnight ago and now, but it didn't happen in the last week, but I figured I'd mention that anyway, is iTunes 10.5.1 was released for both Windows and the Mac. For Mac users, it was more of a bug fix update. It fixed a theoretical problem that probably had no actual way of being exploited. Whereas for Windows people, it fixed a very real problem that could have been exploited and was very dangerous. Basically, there was a bug in Apple's auto software update doohickey where a third party could trigger a pop-up from iTunes to say, oh, there's a new version available, and then choose the URL that you go to.
Worst of all worlds right there.
So that has been patched. And in theory, the Mac is vulnerable if you have a really non-standard setup. So Apple patched it anyway. I believe they actually described it as belt and suspenders in their own security update.
Oh, good.
So for Mac people, I guess it was more of the fact that it was a bug fix update rather than anything else. But for Windows people, if you haven't done 10.5.1, please do. It is very important.
Okay, good.
Then the other thing just to mention, because it's still floating around, it's still attacking people, is the flashback Trojan keeps morphing and mutating, as all of these things do. There's more variants of this thing than I can keep track of at this stage.
Which one was this?
Flashback.
Yeah, which one was it?
Fake Flash installer.
Ah, okay.
So you go to a web page and you get a little broken face that looks like the broken face that Flash puts up. but it's just a JPEG. And then if you're using Safari, an updater will start automatically because, of course, Safari with its open save files by default nonsense will do that. Whereas if you use it, if you have that feature turned off or if you're using any other browser, it would just download the DMG file, which it then can't run. So then you could, I guess, double-click the DMG file if you so wished, but that would be very foolish.
Okay.
So really, if you use Safari, turn off open save files. For goodness sake, turn it off. It's not safe. Never. None. Not at all. No such thing as a safe file.
And they still haven't changed that in the default install, huh?
No, I know. It really annoys me. I think it's disgraceful. So be sure to make that change. And if you get any sort of pop-up you're not expecting, you know, let your suspicious alarm go off. The real Flash updater will pop up. But you can verify that it's real by right-clicking on it in the dock, going to Show in Finder, and it will be in Application Utilities. If it's
that's
real.
How you can tell it's not coming from the web or something like that.
Yeah. So for a start, if it comes up and it's not in your dock at all, then it's fake. Then it's just some graphics on a web page somewhere looking like an installer. But there should be a thing in your dock. And when you right-click on it and show in Finder, so go to Options, Show in Finder, it will be in /Applications/Utilities if it is the real Flash updater.
So does that disappear when it's not running, or would I have it right now just because it's
ever
running?
No, it'll only be there when it's running. So it will appear, and then the icon will show up in your dock, and then you can right-click and show. So it's all being controlled by the system preference pane you now have for Flash.
Okay.
So the system preference pane is running in the background. And when the system preference pane, its little background agent, sees that there's an update, it starts the installer.
Okay, I got you. I have always been meaning to ask you, well, wouldn't it always be sitting in Applications Utilities so this fake thing could be running and then I go look in Applications Utilities?
Well, no,
of course I've got it.
You click on the dock icon of what is running to see that it is the one.
I got you. Okay, cool.
So then the other last thing I just wanted to mention, just sort of an update, I've made a small tweak to xkpasswd.net. There are now presets for generating passwords for your Apple ID because Apple have very, very precise rules. You have to be at least 8 characters, you can't be more than 32 characters, you have to use capitals, you have to use lowercase, you have to use numbers, and you're not allowed to repeat the same symbol more than twice in a row. So I had to make a very special preset for that. But I think it's a pretty decent preset. Beautiful. And I've also added a preset for Windows NTLM passwords. Now, every Windows domain has the power to impose their own restrictions on top of the normal stuff. But NTLM is sort of a reasonable starting point, which is between 8 and 14 characters.
Oh, okay.
So I figured that was reasonable. That should help most Windows people get a reasonable password.
How much does it bother you when you go to a site to put in a secure password and they say things like, oh, you can't use special characters?
A lot. Well, no, it bothers me for two reasons. So the obvious reason is, oh my God, you mean I have to use a less secure password? And that's the obvious reason. But it's actually a symptom of something infinitely worse. It's a symptom that they're not hashing the passwords.
Oh, really?
Because if they're hashing the passwords, they don't give a monkeys about it. They just take your string, hash it, and store the hash. So if they're saying that you must have no more than 16 characters, they're not storing a hash. Because the hash is always the same length. If you hash one character or if you hash 500 characters, the hash is the same length, always. So once anyone starts putting these arbitrary limits on your password length, immediately your alarm bell should go off that they're not storing hashes. So when I see someone say, oh, it must be no more than 8 characters or no more than 16 characters and you're only allowed to use uppercase and lowercase, you're not allowed to use this, that, or the other, that immediately tells me that the likelihood of it being hashed in the background is slim to none. And that tells me that this is someone who I do not trust.
I'm pretty sure I saw it in a bank just recently.
Yep. If you have outdated software systems, and many banks do, let's face it, you know, there's some of them are still running ancient systems. Then you have these bizarre requirements where the password is stored in plain text and it has to fit into a database field of X length. And that's what causes these you know, conditions. Whereas if you hash it, really there's very, very little. You know, you can put on requirements in order to force people to be at least so complex, and that's good. But when you start punishing people for being too complex, that's a sign of problems.
Yeah, definitely. All right.
So,
well, let's get into our main topic now. That was depressing, but necessary.
Yes. So the main topic is timely. I didn't realize how timely it would be until the Black Friday sales kicked off. So I have been mentioning that I am going to do a full review of 1Password, so this is it. And the reason it's timely is that between Black Friday, which was yesterday when we're recording this, and the 30th of November, which is what day of the week?
Today is the 26th, is a Saturday?
So the 30th is next Wednesday. So between now and next Wednesday, you can buy the 1Password stuff in the Mac App Store, the iOS App Store, or on their website for approximately half price. So it's not exactly because of the way these pricing structures work on the App Store, but it's approximately half price.
Okay.
So if you're interested in this, I would strike before Wednesday so that you get the benefit of that pricing.
Okay.
So definitely the time to do this review. So the first thing, so I've broken this review into parts. So the first thing I want to say is what it is. Then I want to give some background of my usage so that you understand how I've been looking at the app, because I haven't looked at it in every possible way for every possible person. Then I want to go through what I love about it. Then I want to go through what I don't like about it. And then I want to do a conclusion.
Okay,
so I hope
sounds
that's
good.
Thorough. So 1Password is a password manager. It will store your passwords in an encrypted format, and with the help of Dropbox, it will sync them between your computers and your devices. So that's the one-liner.
Okay.
But it's much more than passwords, because it doesn't just store web passwords. It can store any kind of password, as well as software license keys, even software license files, because you can have attachments. So you can, some software doesn't give you a key, it gives you an actual physical file. And then you can save that physical file into your Dropbox by adding it as an attachment. And it will encrypt that and keep it safe. You can keep personal information like bank account number, social security number, membership numbers of various organizations, as well as creating generic secure notes, which I use to store hardware information like all of my Macs and iPhones and iPads and things that I look after for myself or for family. I store the serial number, the make, the model, including Apple's little identifier, like mine is an iMac 10,1. Which is just good to know, for if the damn thing blows up in a heap and you can't boot it to figure out what it is, at least you can Google the right thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Back up just a little bit. Are you, with 1Password, is it doing encryption of the passwords automatically, or do you have to actively do something to have it be encrypted in Dropbox?
Everything you put into 1Password is encrypted.
Okay. All right. So we don't have to worry about Dropbox's security.
We do not, because the idea of having an encrypted password container is that you could publish it on the internet and you would still be safe. That's the theory. Now, I don't suggest people try that, but the idea is it's designed to keep your stuff safe, not so you don't have to hide it to keep it safe. So it's perfectly fine. No matter how insecure Dropbox is, you're still fine because it's 1Password giving you the security, not Dropbox.
Okay.
So, as I say, I store the serial number, the make, model, and as well as the numbers of any support calls I've done and the date my Apple Care expires. All in that secure note.
Now, why do you want to have that contained right there?
Well, because if something goes wrong and I need to ring up again, I can give them a reference and say, look, the last time I had this problem, it was call number this.
Oh, okay, so you're keeping track of those calls.
I'm keeping track of those calls. I'm keeping track of when Apple Care expires so that I know when I'm on my own.
Okay.
And obviously stuff like serial number and stuff. So I think it's very handy to have that all together. And 1Password make it very easy to store all of those kinds of information together, which I find handy.
Okay.
I also, you know, there is a Mac version, there is a Windows version, there is an iOS version, and there are readers for Android and Windows Phone.
Readers.
They are readers. So in other words, you have a read-only view into your 1Password stuff on the Android and the Windows phones, whereas you have read and write on Mac, Windows, and iOS.
Okay.
As well as all of that, you also have... So you have the app. So there is an actual real app. And as well as that, there are browser plugins that integrate that real app into your various browsers. So there are plugins for basically all the modern browsers, Safari on the Mac, IE on Windows, and Chrome and Firefox on both. There is a beta version of the Safari browser on Windows, as in a beta version of the plugin for Safari on Windows, and there is obviously no version for IE on the Mac because that doesn't exist.
Okay.
So you may use other browsers, so the browser plugins may not be for you, but that is a pretty good range of coverage there with those four browsers. There is sync via Dropbox. And if you do that, you also get a lovely little bonus where inside your Dropbox, there'll be a HTML page that will allow you to read your passwords if you know your password to your Dropbox. So there's JavaScript that will do the decryption in your web browser. So you can actually just go to the web page, type in your master password, and read out your passwords.
You just said if you know the password to your Dropbox, you mean if you know the password to your one password file, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, good.
Which is a lovely little feature if you're not on any of your own devices and you just need to quickly look something up. So I like that a lot.
So there isn't just a straight web interface to 1Password?
Because it's sitting in your Dropbox, if you sync at all. Or you may decide not to sync.
But if you were sitting on somebody else's computer...
Yeah, I would log into Dropbox.com on the webpage.
Oh, okay, but you don't log into 1Password.com to do that.
No, you don't, because 1Password do not store your passwords. Your passwords are your passwords, and they never go anywhere near 1Password.
Oh, that's different. Okay.
It's different, and I like it, because it means that they can be subpoenaed till the cows come home. They can go into the worst countries in the world with the most corrupt governments in the world, and they can't be forced to hand over anything because they ain't got nothing.
Okay.
They've only sold you up, and that's all they have. So they have your money in it. And another thing that 1Password can do is it can generate passwords for you. So if you literally want to just hand over everything to 1Password, you can say, I want a different password for every single website I visit, and I want you to generate them for me, and then you'll just automatically fill them in for me. And so you can do that, and then the result is that you don't have no password reuse, and you have good, strong passwords.
And do you do that?
No, because I use xkpasswd to generate my passwords.
Okay, all right.
But you can. It's in there, and they have a couple of different schemes, including what they call pronounceable passwords.
Oh, that's
which
neat.
Are designed, yeah, it's designed to be easy to hand people over the phone. So I like that touch. That's a neat little touch. So pricing, I think we definitely should cover, because it's not a cheap app. Right now, at sort of its approximately half price, you can buy it on the Mac App Store for $24.99, which is until the 30th of November, at which point it reverts to $49.99.
Okay, so hopefully people are listening to this early in the week.
Hopefully, yes. iOS, the iOS universal version that works on the iPhone and the iPad is currently $6.99, and it will go back to $14.99 on the 31st of November. Does that exist? That's the 1st of December, isn't it? There are no 30 days in November.
30 days, September, April, June, November. 30 days in November, yes.
Yeah. The Windows version is available from their website, so agilebits.com/store, and that is currently $24.99. It will go to $49.99. And then the read-only versions for Android and Windows are always free, so half of free is still free.
So if you're a slider, even on the sale prices, you're talking about $50 to go between the Mac and the PC.
Yes, and if you want to throw iOS into the mix, you're talking another $7 on top of that.
And that's a half-price sale.
Yes. Now, if you're a sort of a Mac-y person like me, it's $24.99 plus $6.99, which is very reasonable. Because that covers all of your iOS devices and your Macs.
One thing I did want to make a little disclaimer in here is that we do have a couple of really good friends who work at AgileBits, representing 1Password. Both Nick and Stu work there. But I did want to put a little tiny disclaimer in there, but I think we're both fairly rational on this one. So what makes you use this or even consider this versus 1Password, which is 100% free? And LastPass. LastPass, which is free, cross-platform, browser-based, browser plugins, iPhone app.
Yeah, its desktop app is rubbish because it doesn't seem to have one for the Mac.
It's just web-based.
Yeah, but for me, passwords aren't web-based. There is no more than half of my passwords are web-based. And of the information I want keep secure, like my bank account numbers, my credit card numbers, my Irish equivalent of social security number, my software keys, my hardware details, all of that stuff, that just doesn't fit into LastPass. LastPass is a web password solution. Great.
Well,
but it doesn't...
Well, no. I'm just saying that the interface is web-based. I'm not saying the thing needs to be web-based.
Sure, but I don't like... I like real apps. You know what I'm like with my Cocoa apps.
Okay.
I feel that a real, solid, well-built app gives you much better usability than a web page ever can. And I really like the fact that the 1Password people have done that. They have built a really good OS X app. And it doesn't feel like a ported app. Like, it's a good, solid Cocoa app.
So is there something you can do with that you can't do with LastPass?
I'm not sure the word is can't. Because I could... do all sorts of things. I could write all of my programs in assembly language. I could do all sorts of things that I would hate.
Well,
so I don't think could is the right word. Yes, you could.
I took all of my license keys, and I created what they call secure notes, and they have a section for license keys, and it says what's the software company's name and what's the website for the software company, you know, so you can keep track of that. If you have a contact name, you go through there, and what's the license key? And I shoved them all in there, and so now I know I can go at any time, and I can say, what's my, Skype license key or whatever it would be.
Well, you have so 1Password, when you add your software in, it will actually look in your applications folder and tell you what version you currently have installed, and it will use the app's icon. So when you're looking through a list of all of your passwords, you're scanning them by their icon.
That's nice.
Which is very nice, and it will tell
you. Except I have 158 applications, so I don't like looking at any by icons.
Yeah, but you can. I mean, you can start searching, searching and locking them down, and then you have. You have a lot of sort of app-based things like tags and smart folders and all those kind of things that you won't really get in non-app apps.
I have to say that finding the secure notes after the fact or finding where you create them is a little bit dodgy because it's not where you create other logins. But I do like the plugins for the browsers work great.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on... If you're the kind of person who is, if you look at the stuff that you care about saving and it's 90% web and you're happy to do a little bit, you're happy to have a slightly poorer experience for the 10%, then, you know, LastPass is going to work for you. Mm-hmm. But in my case, because I do so much server admin, I have passwords to servers, I have passwords to all sorts of stuff. For me, web is a small part of what I need a solution for. I don't want a solution that's focused on the web. I want a solution that's focused on saving my data. So I really didn't feel happy with LastPass because I didn't think it suited what I was looking for.
Okay.
So I guess that takes us into sort of the background of my review. So I have been using the OS X version. I have been using the iOS version. I have not used the Windows version. I have not used the Android version. And I have not used the Windows Phone version. So I don't know what they're like. I can only speak for what I've used. I am also not using the browser plugins. Because I have decided I don't want that extra complexity. I don't want my browser updates to be entangled with my password management system. So what I do is I use OS X's keychain to cache my passwords, for want of a better phrase. And anytime I have a cache miss, I just command tab over to 1Password and put in the right password and then it's fine.
Wait. You command tab over to 1Password, so you are using it in the browser version.
No. Well, no, I'm using the desktop version of 1Password is always open on my machine because I need it there for when I need to get out server passwords.
So you command tab, copy, and command tab back and paste.
Yeah. So on the very rare occasion,
that's clunky, Bart.
Yeah, but that's a rare occasion. That's not the norm, right? The norm is the browser just has my password. So the only time that I ever
so you're letting the browser store your passwords.
In the encrypted OS X keychain, in the case of Chrome, and in an encrypted keychain in Firefox using a master password in Firefox.
So my passwords are never... in two places.
Oh, but I don't. I have one master list and I have a cache. And so as far as I'm concerned, if I need to look up a password, there is only one place where the answer is 1Password. But for my convenience, they are cached in my browser.
I thought, could have sworn a long time ago you told us never to let our browsers store our passwords.
Unless you set a master password in Firefox to encrypt them, which I do. And they're saved in your keychain, which is encrypted anyway.
I don't let either of them store passwords ever, 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 and I always let LastPassword do it instead.
Fine, because you're using a browser-integrated version, and that works perfectly well. I may be a bit odd. So the only reason I'm mentioning that I do this is because... I want people to understand that I may not be using it in exactly the way they're using it, so I want to be honest about what I have and haven't tested. I'm not suggesting everyone do it my way. I'm just saying what I do. To be honest, part of it is simply a carryover from when I used Password Vault, which didn't have any browser integration at all. That was how I always did things. And so what I've done is I've replaced my old manager with a new manager, and I've kept my workflow.
Okay.
So, and I just did want to mention that in my case, I'm not looking at a solution for web passwords. I'm looking at a solution for all of my passwords. And I did a sort of a quick rough count, and it's about 50% web, 50% everything else.
Okay.
So, the good. The Agile Bits have a really good thing on their website where you can go and read about the design of their keychain. And it explains the cryptography, it explains the aims they had when designing the cryptography. So you can have a look at it and you can satisfy yourself that the design of this app is sound. I cannot verify that there are no bugs in it because it is a closed source app. But I can say that when I read that file describing the design and the intentions and the motivations and the things they had in their mind as problems to be solved, it holds up well. And that's all we can ever say about a closed source app, is that from what we're being told by the vendor, this is very good. So I think they're very open about it. I like that page a lot that I've linked in the show notes.
Okay.
So that's a good start. It's a native Cocoa app, and it really feels like a Mac app. It behaves like you would expect, and it doesn't do odd things that make you go, what the... You know, it doesn't have that sort of friction.
That jolting.
So, yeah, there's none of that. Yeah, so you feel at home, which I like. And you know what I'm like. I'm very big on consistency. So I like that. It's done well. The other thing I love is that the first time you run the app, it doesn't give you big blank screens where your lists of passwords will be. It gives you really helpful instructions to tell you what to do.
Oh, okay.
Which is much friendlier to people than a big empty screen. So I like that. They thought about that well, and they did it well. So I like that a lot. They also have a good range of templates for capturing your information. And they have little icons to go with them as well. So there's actually a template there for a server hosting account. And so you have stuff for storing, you know, who is this server hosted with, username and password to log into the server, the web interface for managing the server. And it's the sensible fields that you would want if you were to be the kind of person who owned a server at GoDaddy or something. Mm-hmm. And then they have templates for email addresses. So you can save the server details as well as the username and password. And they have templates for FTP accounts, and they have templates for social security numbers, and they have templates for bank accounts, and templates for credit cards, and templates for more things than I can shake a stick at. So they have all these templates so that what you capture, so that they have fields ready for you to capture all the relevant information. Any field you don't use disappears from view when you hit save. So just like in the address book, when you hit edit, you see all these extra fields.
Oh, that's nice. That's really nice. So you don't see a bunch of empty fields. That's a sign of good design in my book.
Yes, exactly. And so it reminds me of address book in that sort of sense, that when you hit the edit button, you see all this glop. And then once you hit save, all the glop vanishes and all that's left is the information you actually care about. So that I like that. And the templates, there's a lot of them and they're very sensible. And so that's good. Because it uses Dropbox as its synchronization engine, now I believe there's an iCloud option either coming or here. So for people who don't like Dropbox, that will be an option. Because it uses Dropbox, and because Dropbox is very good at dealing with proxy servers and all those kind of things, 1Password inherits that goodness.
Okay. So that helps you with going in and out of work.
It helps me a lot with going in and out of work, because stuff like Password Vault that rolls its own, I couldn't do a sync. So I would sync my thumb drive version only when I was at home. I couldn't sync my thumb drive version when I was not at home. So because it uses Dropbox, which is really well put together that way, I get all that functionality for free with 1Password, which I like.
Okay.
The other thing I noticed as I was using it over time is that it keeps a history of your passwords. So as you change your passwords, it doesn't delete the old ones. It just keeps a list of your old passwords, all obviously encrypted as well. So you can watch what you've used before and you can avoid reuse very easily, because you really don't want to do that. That sort of completely negates...
the whole purpose.
Yeah, exactly. Completely negates the security you get by changing your password. The other thing I like is that if you buy iOS, you can, at the moment, and I'm not sure if that's going to stay, it may be a legacy thing, but you can buy them individually, but there is a universal app so that you can have one purchase that will work on all of your iOS devices.
Oh, I hope they do that. I just hate it when it's a separate app. It's just...
So at the moment, you can buy separate or you can buy universal, but I'm not sure if the separate is going to stay around forever. But there is a universal, and that's all that matters to me.
Right.
Then they also have import support for lots and lots of apps. It was a very long list and stuff like CSV files and all sorts of stuff in there, but it didn't include Password Vault. Now, I don't care, because I wanted to do, as part of my spring clean we talked about a few weeks ago, I wanted to do a manual move over and to fix stuff as I brought it in. So that didn't bother me.
Sure.
But if you're using one of many other apps, there is actually proper import features, which people may find handy. The other thing to say is that when you can get to customer support, it is superb. The people have been very friendly, they have been very helpful, and they've been very well informed. But there have been times when I've been a user of this app where their support has been overwhelmed, is the only word I can use for it. So overwhelmed that they actually removed the email address from their website and told people to use their forums, which made me cranky. Ooh, that made me cranky.
Now, was that right during the Lion fiasco? As I recall, that was a bit of a bumpy ride.
It was during the point where they had just launched on the Mac App Store, just as Lion had come out. Which, I'm not sure if that was wise of them to do two things at once like that. But yeah, so it was very busy for them at that time. And they had it on a special offer, because I bought it at the 50% off price as well. So maybe
I don't think that's a common occurrence that they have that problem, is all I'm saying. I think that was kind of a perfect storm they ran into there.
Possibly. The other thing which I do want to add is that since that perfect storm happened, they're rolling out a whole new support system. And that, I've had a play on the new system that looks a lot nicer than the old system, so that may just simply not be an issue. So what I know for sure is that the actual people who you get to when you get to them are very good. And although I did have some trouble getting to them, I don't think that problem will continue thanks to this new system. So fingers crossed that's all good.
Okay.
I also love the fact, and we already briefly mentioned this, that you have sort of very OS X-like features of tagging and smart folders, or just manual folders by dragging and dropping related items together. So you can very easily organize stuff on the Mac app. This is not true in the iOS version, by the way. This is only true in the Mac version.
Do the organizational things that you've done on the Mac side show up over on the iOS side?
Nope.
Oh.
So the smart folders exist on your Mac, and they do not exist on iOS. Now, smart folders don't contain actual data. So all of your passwords are on iOS. But that nice little organization you've done is not. So I have a smart folder, which I just called disk encryption. And all of my encrypted DMGs, my encrypted Macs, and my encrypted external drives, all of those are tagged with a tag disk encryption. And the smart folder looks for that tag and makes that smart folder. So whenever I need to find a disk password, it's very easy to find in that smart album or smart folder. But I don't have that luxury on iOS. I only have that luxury on the Mac. So it's great that they're there. And I'm, you know, over time, these things can all be updated. So I'm hopeful they'll make their way to iOS. But on the Mac, they work really nice.
Yeah, some consistency there would be good.
Exactly. The other thing then is that searching on OS X is very nice. So you begin to search no matter what section you're in. It defaults to searching everything, but like the Finder, it gives you a radio button across the top where you can say, no, I only want to search my web passwords. Or I want to search everything. So it's very Finder-like in how it behaves that way when you type into the search box, which again is nice, makes you feel at home OS X-y stuff. And the search is nice and snappy and effective. Like, it seems to be searching on a lot of fields because I always find what I want.
Oh, that's good.
Which is good, and easily and quickly, because the search box is just in the top corner there. Like in the Finder, it's just always there. So that works nicely. Again, not true in iOS. We'll talk about that when we get to the bad. The other nice thing I like is that whenever you make changes, it does an automatic encrypted backup for you. So that if something were to go horribly wrong in sync and it were to accidentally wipe out all of your data, it's not gone. You can simply say restore from backup or rewind to where you were 5 days ago.
Wait. Where is that backup stored?
It's stored on your Mac, but automatically, and it is in an encrypted format.
So you've got a copy in Dropbox, but there's also another copy hidden on your Mac somewhere?
All of your backups are on your Mac.
Well, okay. The one in Dropbox is on Dropbox and your Mac. You're saying there's another one that's just on your Mac?
Yes. So it's in the applications folder, like, you
okay.
know.
Okay.
And you can access them through the interface, but when you say restore from backup, and it'll give you a list of all the dates and times.
Oh, that's good.
You don't have to remember to do that. It just does that. And you can manually say, I want a snapshot now, and then it will do a backup. But you don't have to remember. And that's good, because that way it saves you from problems. Because having to remember, not so good. And then the other thing I like is that the Mac App Store version is already sandboxed. So there is no fear of it stopping working in March 2012 when sandboxing becomes mandatory, because it's sandboxed already. So it's already done that changeover.
Okay.
So that's a list of some of the things I really like. So now we have to do what I always do and poke some fun at the shortcomings. And there are shortcomings.
I was going to say, this was too much joy in a row for a while.
Yeah. Now, the first one, I guess, has a slight silver lining because the problem seems to be fixed. But initially, I had sync issues, and sync issues really make me worried. and concerned. And my first experience was that when I tried to do the Dropbox syncing, the first Mac synced to Dropbox just fine. The second Mac effectively imported from Dropbox rather than keeping syncing with it.
So then what was happening? Right over what you had on that second device?
No, it seemed to just take a copy of the Dropbox data and make a new data file out of that copy. So I was adding stuff on my home machine, which was going up to Dropbox as it should. And then that stuff was never coming into the version in work. And then I was adding stuff in work that was never going out to Dropbox and therefore also never making it back home. And after a few days of this, I basically had two completely incompatible libraries. Because neither of them had all of my data, and each of them had data that was not in the other. Turns out that with the help of support, it was fixed by basically using the date range to select all changes since the problem started on both and exporting them in sort of one password, sort of intermediate format. So you can export it to a sort of a pseudo text file and then you can import it. So basically export everything that was missing on the version that was actually syncing properly, import those into the version that was actually syncing properly, and then reestablish sync on the one that was not syncing properly. And since that has been done, it has been absolutely fine, and there was an update released to the apps, to the Mac App Store, to fix the bug that caused mine to break in the first place.
Oh. So they actually were able to diagnose it and fix it from that?
They were able to diagnose it and fix it, and support was very good, because that was not a simple operation when two things get out of sync, and my immediate response was panic. And I was quickly reassured that, don't worry, everything is fine. For no matter what happens, those backups are in there, and I went and verified, and indeed they were there. And then we're going to use this simple technique of creating a smart folder for everything that happened between the last time the sync was good and now, and capturing just that data and exporting just that data, and then being able to import just that data. So using the features of the app, it was actually easy to solve what sounded like a really serious problem. So on the one sense, that was a positive experience because it showed me that their support is good and that the app actually has thought about these things. Now, on the other hand, it made me worry about the robustness of sync. Because over literally years of using Password Vault Sync, I never had a single bug. And I had been using 1Password for a week and I'd already hit the biggest sync problem I've ever had.
I can't imagine how cranky you were right then. I've seen you on Twitter when you're unhappy, and that must have been a bad day for them.
It was. Yeah.
Now, let's ask when I found out
that they wouldn't take email anymore because they were too busy. And that I should post on a public forum instead of contacting the person I just paid a lot of money.
Mm. So now, do you think you got good support because you know the people?
I don't think so, because I could have IM'd Stu at any moment and taken myself out of the support loop, but I didn't, because I knew I was going to be writing this review.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't contact Stu, I didn't contact Nick, I only dealt with the @Twitter account as if I was a normal person.
Okay.
So I'd like to think I'm not famous enough that just random people would know who I was. I really don't think I'm Leo Laporte. So I think I got an honest sort of what anyone else would get experience.
Okay.
I hope. Because I wanted to not use any of my connections so that I could give a review that was fair. So then the other thing to say is I did also have a very minor sync issue on the iOS device, which was very, very quickly resolved. Turn sync off, turn sync on. All changes synced both ways. Everything was fine.
Oh,
it was just like
good.
It stalled rather than it stopped working.
Good, good.
And since then, literally for weeks and weeks now, because I started using this quite a few months ago and I didn't want to review it till I was sure, for literally weeks and weeks and weeks now, there has been no problem at all with syncing. So this may have just gone away. I may have just been unfortunate. I was an early adopter. I got the very, very first Mac App Store version.
Okay. All right. And it sounds like they did work on the root cause, not just here's how you fix the symptom.
Precisely, and they were good about asking me for crash logs, and it wasn't crash logs, but for logs and various bits and pieces. So it was a two-way flow of information, and that's what I like, because that's a sign that they care, is when the information is two-way.
Yeah.
Then the next thing to mention is there were also initial bugs with smart folders, which also seem to have resolved themselves. And then there's a really annoying fact that smart folders don't sync to iOS, and they also don't sync to the Dropbox web interface.
Yeah, that kind of defeats the purpose of having them, in my opinion.
It does. Now, I would expect...
Because that means if you've got two Macs syncing through Dropbox, that means they don't have the smart folders on both Macs even,
right?
No, it doesn't
mean that. Because it's a Dropbox web interface that loses them, not Dropbox
itself. Oh, okay. So the metadata associated with the smart folders does exist?
the metadata is there, but the Dropbox web interface can't read it. Okay. Because the Dropbox web interface hasn't been updated since smart folders were invented or added. Not invented, added. Now, I would imagine, I don't know this, I don't know this for a fact, but I would imagine that in future releases, that obvious oversight will be fixed and smart folders will simply start working everywhere. And I hope so, because that would make me very happy.
But you don't have any reason to believe that yet. You're just ever hopeful?
Well, the reason I would say I have the reason to believe it is because the app is under very active development.
Okay.
And when I expressed my concerns, they were taken on board to support. So I do think that they're listening and that they're doing stuff.
Okay. And you've forwarded on this request?
Yes, I have forwarded on. And anytime I run, you know what I'm like, anytime you see me whining on Twitter, I will have also sent a comment to the relevant person. So if I say something bad about Apple, I will have gone to apple.com/feedback and said the same thing. So whenever you see me tweeting about something, I will have informed the vendor of exactly the same thing.
Okay.
And I always do that. So then we get to the iOS version, which is a whole lot of complaining. Because the first initial response is immediately bad. Hmm. You buy a universal app, and what they've actually done is they've taken the iPhone app and the iPad app, which are completely different, and just wrapped them into one app that has an if statement that says, if I am an iPad, I will run this entirely different app, and if I am an iPhone, I will run this entirely different app.
Why is that so bad? There is
zero unity, zero continuity of experience, zero even continuity of the philosophy of the design. On the iPhone, the security model is completely different to the way it is on the Mac or on the iPad. So there's just nothing uniting between the quote-unquote universal...
Wait. The security model is different? You mean the way they protect the information is different?
Yep. On the iPhone, they have this notion of a PIN number that you have to set, as well as your master password.
Okay.
Which makes no sense to me, because initially I believe it was a case that it was PIN-only on iOS, which I think is a disastrous idea. Because then you have four numbers protecting all of your information instead of a big long alphanumeric password.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a strong master password, but I still have to use the PIN and the strong master password on the iPhone. But I don't have to do it on the iPad. Nothing about the two interfaces feels like it. You know the way normally you feel like it's simply a smaller version of the other app. The same idea, but they've just rearranged the UI so that your fingers will fit easily on a smaller screen. There's no feeling of that. These are two completely different apps. The iPad one feels very, very like the Mac app and looks very like the Mac app and philosophically is very like the Mac app. The iPhone app is completely different. And with the one universal app, what you basically get is those two separate apps mushed together.
So do you get the sense that they wrote the iPad app maybe from scratch after they'd worked on the Mac app? And so there's some unity there, but the iPhone app maybe is left over from past days?
That's exactly how it feels. So the iPhone app is older and hasn't yet had a full rewrite, whereas the iPad app has had a full rewrite. Which, again, makes me think that at some stage in the future, the iPhone app will get the upgrade that the iPad app seems to have already gotten. So this is all fixable, of course, but right now, this minute, I cannot say I'm a fan of the iOS app.
Okay.
Then the other thing that I just don't understand, there's no lock button. Like, there's no button to say lock now.
So there's not, like, a log out lock?
Yeah. So on the Mac version, you can just click a button and instantly the cover comes over and your passwords are, you know, it's a nice animation of the thing locking up like a vault. But there's no equivalent to that. So what you have to do is you have to set a really short timeout on the auto lock feature instead. But then as you're using multitasking to switch over and back, so you want to log into something... You switch into one password, you unlock it with your big long password, then you enter your PIN if you're using the iPhone. Then you copy the username, you use the multitasking thing to go back to wherever you're going, you paste in the username, then you switch back to one password to copy the password, and then you switch back. But if you have it set to auto-lock on exit, then you need to enter your big long password twice, or else you set it to a slow timeout. But really, what I would just want is a long timeout and a lock button, so that when I'm done, I just say close. So again, this is something that needs work in future versions. It's not a pleasant flow. You feel like you're fighting against the app instead of the app working with you, and I never like that.
Right.
The other thing that just drives me potty on both iOS versions is that there is no global search. So there are categories, passwords, software keys, wallet, secure notes. You have these categories. And on the Mac version, when you do a search, it defaults to searching across all the categories. So it doesn't matter where you've saved something, you'll find it.
Okay.
On the iOS versions, the search is limited to the category you happen to be in at the moment. You hit the magnifying glass.
And you can't hit them all at the same time?
Nope. No way to hit them all. So then you're sitting there trying to think, did I save that as a secure note, or did I manage to put that in as a generic account? And you want to get everything related to Google, but you can't because some of them are email accounts, some of them are other accounts. And I just really annoying that you have to start thinking, what is it, before you can search for it. So I don't like that. And I think searching is important. So again, that's something that needs work in future versions. So as far as I'm concerned, the iOS versions are fantastic for getting you out of a bind. I look at them as being the equivalent of the old thumb drive version of Password Vault that I would only ever use from time to time when I needed a password while away from home. And so the example I use it for a lot is when someone comes to visit and I have to give them my Wi-Fi password, I just bring it up on the iPhone and hand the iPhone over to them and they can type across. And it's now an XKPassWD version of my Wi-Fi password.
So it's actually doable. Possible to do it by a human now? Because I don't want to get off on that again, Bart.
Yes, exactly. So it's now humanly possible, and I bring it up in 1Password on the iPhone, and I put the iPhone on the table next to their computer, and they can just read over, type it in, and they're on our Wi-Fi. And I had to do the same myself when the better half got a new iPhone. You know, so it's perfect for that kind of, I'm out and about, and I just need a quick look at a password. Mm-hmm. But it's no good for managing your password. So it just feels infinitely inferior to the OS X app, but perfectly good to get you by.
Let's say, for example, you were a Facebook user, and I know you're not, but let's just use that as an example. Let's just pretend. And you wanted to log into Facebook, and you've got this nice long password that's been created for you by 1Password. What is the process? You're sitting on your iPhone waiting at the Department of Motor Vehicles, which you don't have either. I don't get how that works.
Okay, so you bring up the iPhone app, you go into 1Password, you search for Facebook, and then you hit the button to copy the username, then you use multitasking to switch back to the Facebook app or browser, whatever way you're doing it. You paste it in, and then you switch back to 1Password, you copy the password, and you paste it in.
Oh my gosh, that's ridiculous. I'm not doing that. I've already moved on.
What else can you do on iOS, though?
Well, on the LastPass browser on the iPad, for example, and on the iPhone, you just use it as your browser, and it knows what your passwords are because you enter your secure password.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that feature exists and I just don't know about it because I would use it for email passwords more than anything else. Let me just double check that there is no browse inside the app before I say it doesn't do that.
Yeah, because it might be you find Facebook in there and you hit it and it launches Facebook over in Safari. That would make a lot more sense.
A random example of a website just to test. So
I mean, because I think about banking, any of those kind of places, if you got to click back and forth, I hope that's not right.
We see, the only time I use it is when I set up a new email account, and then you kind of have to do that because there is nothing else you can do, and that's perfectly reasonable to set up an account once.
Sure.
You know? Because I had to do that a lot when I did my whole changing all of my email providers thing. And that was just a bunch of once-offs, and it didn't bother me because it was much easier than having to type them in because I could copy and paste. Okay, so here is a password for 500px, and I hit the website arrow, and what happens? Ah! It has an integrated browser. Okay.
There we go. Okay, good.
Okay, so it does that trick too.
So you go straight in.
Yeah, okay. Glad we checked that out.
I could just hear Stu and Stu screaming at their iPods. Hey, so, come on, we've had to do it ourselves. It's about time we spread the joy.
Well, precisely. So that's my list of bad stuff. So I just thought I'd end with a sort of an overall conclusions and say that for me, having come from Password Vault and moving to 1Password, my workflow has stayed the same, but my user experience has gone up 20 million notches. So for me, it has been a wonderful upgrade because it's a really nice app. It's just a well-put-together Mac app, and you know how I love well-put-together Mac apps. So it's one of those, and I like it, and I think they've done a good job with the Mac app. So as far as I'm concerned, all they have to do for OS X to make it perfect for me in version 4 that they're working on at the moment is that you need to give me the ability to have customizable templates so I can add templates of my own instead of having to revert to a secure note when my weird and funny thing doesn't match any of their hundreds of pre-prepared templates. And the ability to tweak templates because some of them are a bit US-centric and I find that's not ideal. So if I could just tweak the templates, I'd be happy. iOS, on the other hand, they have a lot of work to do to make me happy. But at the same time, it's usable. It's not pleasant. I don't think it's well designed. I think it's missing features. But it does work. So that at least is something. But I think they have a lot of work to do to make a great iOS app. You know, whereas they don't have much work to do on the Mac because it is a great app and it could just do it some tweaking. And then the last thing I'll say is that at the sale price, I think it's value for money. At the full price, I think it's overpriced.
Because there are alternatives that are perhaps not as good, but...
Well, that's one way to look at it. But the other way I look at these things is compare it to other apps at that price range. So for that amount of money, I could buy the whole of iLife or of iWork a few times over. That doesn't seem appropriate. Aperture is $80. Is that a bigger app than all of this 1Password stuff? I'd say it is.
Yeah. I wonder if they're pricing it based on how much you could lose.
I guess. I mean, ultimately, you price it whatever, you know, you price it at the highest price people are prepared to pay. I mean, that's sort of the market capitalism at its core. But I like to look at things in terms of, if I took that money and I went to spend it on other apps, what else could I get for my money? And is that comparable value for money? And I don't look at this and say, this is equivalent in complexity to Aperture, therefore I'm happy to pay the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't think that holds up. And you're talking about, you know, $50 plus $14, you're up to $64 to have iOS and Mac. That's a lot of money.
Right, right. Especially since there is a free version, or a free, let's not call it equivalent, but perhaps passable.
It's an option. So,
yeah. So split the difference, is, $25 sounds pretty good.
Exactly. At $25, it sounds like a reasonable trade-off. More usability and more generic solution. Whereas the free version is free, as its upside, but isn't quite as powerful. So that's a reasonable trade-off. But $65 versus free? Yeah. You're just kind of like going, yeah, okay, the shortcomings are tolerable now.
Right. What is that worth to you?
Exactly. So it does come down to what it's worth to you. So I would say that at the sale price, I don't hesitate in recommending it. I think it's value for money. At the full price, I don't recommend it.
You know, I think it's the pricing things that have gone on in the Mac App Store have really started to make this more competitive space financially, too.
They have.
You know, I mean, when we bought Aperture, it was $200, but now it's $70 for all the Macs in your house. So there's kind of an expectation, I think, that the prices come down and you get it for more Macs.
Exactly. And I get the feeling that some of the companies that have been around longer are still stuck in the old model. So, like, Panic Software is still charging quite a lot for Transmit, and Agile Bits have been around longer than the App Store. So I get the feeling that the penny hasn't quite dropped yet. They're still at the... If Aperture was $200 and you compared the functionality of Aperture to the functionality of 1Password for $60, you would say good value for money.
Right, right.
So in the pre-App Store world, this price is sensible.
But now
we're not in the pre-App Store world. We're in the App Store world. And so Apple give developers so much... They don't have to do their own marketing. They don't have to do their own credit card processing. They don't have to do their own hosting. They don't have to worry about all these servers and stuff. They pay $99 a year and they code, and that's all they have to do. And support, and let's not leave support out, but that's always there no matter what way you look at it.
Sure.
So the App Store has changed the model, and I just don't feel that this price is new world. I think it's old world.
Yep. Well, maybe they'll listen to that too. Hey, I wanted to add one more thing I threw in the show notes. If you refresh your screen, you'll see it. Okay. Don McAllister did a tutorial on 1Password 3.9 and the Mac App Store and shows exactly how it works with the browser plugins and the whole thing. That is one of the members' tutorials, but it is a fantastic episode. Really, really shows you how this works. So if you're not a Screencast Online member, you ought to be.
And this is why.
And yeah, here's exactly one of the reasons why.
I love that no matter what app you pick, you can be pretty sure that either as a free show or a member show, Don has talked about it.
And no matter how good you are at this stuff, Don is better at it and will show you things that you've
He's found features
seen.
That you didn't know were there and that you were probably doing silly things to make work when you could have done a simple thing.
Embarrassing level of things. I think I've told the story about when he did something on Aperture and it was on the import screen and he went over to the right-hand side of the screen and started changing all these options. I'd never even noticed there was something on the right-hand side. Never
don't feel bad, Allison.
You hadn't either?
I knew from screenshots that it was possible to do all these new things on import, and it took me ages to see how. And when I did eventually figure out how, I kicked myself as well. But I didn't find it particularly obvious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the natural heat maps always show that people look on the left side and across the top, and they don't look on the right side. So I don't completely blame myself, but somehow Don sees the right-hand side of the screen.
Yeah. I guess if you were to take the time to read Apple's documentation, you'd know about it. But you and I are not known for that particular trait.
Not our strength. I like having Don spoon feed me. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'll wholeheartedly agree with that.
There we go. All right, well, that was pretty interesting. Each time you hear about 1Password, maybe I'll try it again. Got to see what this is all about.
There is a free trial on their website, isn't there?
I don't remember, but...
Not on the Mac App Store, because you can't get those through the Mac App Store, but I think there is a trial on the website.
Okay,
I'll double
cool.
check that. Now, let's make sure I'm not talking rubbish, because otherwise they'll have a whole lot of support calls saying, I heard on this podcast...
All right, fine. We'll look it up.
Well, I don't want to be There's wrong.
Good, yeah. Like well, it has a download button.
Okay, so what happens when I click it? Let's download see. Now. 1Password for my... Must.
Up. Yeah, free trial. No,
free trial. Okay, there we go.
Wait, no, free newsletter.
Oh.
Well, it's downloading. And I didn't pay him anything. All right, well, your mileage may vary, but...
It does look like it's a free trial, doesn't it?
It's saying end user license agreement. This is good audio, though.
Oh, it's wonderful audio. Yeah, so experiment for yourself.
We don't make any promises or warranties. Yeah, if we're wrong, we'll give you your money back on this episode.
Which costs $0, so we'll even give you 200% of your money back.
All right, Bart, well, thanks for bringing us up to speed on the latest here.
No problem at all. I guess 2 weeks from now is not yet Christmas funny season, so it should be business as usual, right?
That sounds good.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got Screen Steps and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. I contribute a fair amount over on Google Plus nowadays, so just search for me by name, and if you want to circle me up, check me out over there. If you want to join the fun in the live show, and I highly recommend it, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Mozilla Castaways. And don't forget to sign up for the party at Macworld Expo, or I'm sorry, Macworld iWorld. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.